This is Japan Baseball Weekly, the only English podcast covering all 12 NPB teams. And now, your hosts, John E. Gibson and Jim Allen.
Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast. It's for the week of October 5th. I'm John Gibson, and with me on a Sunday night at a nice time in the 10 o'clock hour is Jim Allen. What's happening, bud?
It's Sunday, baby. I mean, it's like really Sunday.
Sunday.
Obviously that's good.
It's always good because that means it's taping day.
Okay.
And I'm glad to be here at a decent hour. That means I can go to sleep maybe fairly early, not stay up all night, and then watch some football tomorrow. So excellent.
Wow, good for you.
All right, a shout out to everyone doing their part in the fight against the coronavirus worldwide and domestically. And you know, we continue to battle. Thank you, and mask up, and let's beat this thing, guys. Mm-hmm. All right, on this week's show, we got to get to it because we got a long interview with Yakult Swallows International Advisor Aaron Guile. We've got the mini track segment, we've got Players of the Month, and more. So let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases.
All right, so basically we have had no luck or cooperation from the Swallows on talking to players this season. So I just said, you know, forget it. We want to talk to more teams and spread the love here and get some perspective about what's going on with the Tokyo Yakult Swallows. So I contacted Aaron Guile, former slugger with the Swallows, and I also reached out to Tony Barnett. They're both international advisors. They both apparently they live around the corner from each other, but I did speak to Tony at camp, and Aaron got back to me first, and I said, let's set up a date, and we did. And then Tony he sent me this meme. It was a meme of a guy looking at his watch waiting because he was waiting for me to get back to him. So I had not gotten back to him, so I said, hey, look, can we slide you to later in the year and you know, do a slide step, you know, quick pitch with Aaron Guile and get you later in the year. And he said, okay, slide me, baby. So we're going to slide him down the road a little bit. But now with Aaron, he was at his son's football game. Now, I didn't ask if it was high school or what level, so I'm just assuming it was probably peewee. And we won't play this episode for his son so that his son eventually discovers that dad wasn't really watching for about 30 minutes of this game. We won't tell him that. We'll hide the episode. But
we'll bury it.
Yeah. We had a number of interruptions. We were first using Line, and Line kept sending error messages, and then Line was dropping the call, and there were assorted colorful background noises with the football game, and we have people screaming, and there's a little bit of activity going on in the background, but it all makes for very fun and very colorful interview. So let's take a listen. We are glad to be joined by Aaron Guile, former Swallows player and current advisor with the team. How are you doing, man?
All things considered, doing well. You know, the weather, you know, real hot weather in Arizona starting to cool down, and you know, at least we're just like everybody else. We're making do. Everyone's so far healthy and happy, and so just really looking forward to things getting back to some type of normalcy.
Yeah, some type. What part of Arizona are you in?
I'm located in Phoenix. Originally came here when I was with the Royals, and got a home here. Lived here ever since. And then when I stopped playing with the Swallows, I already had a home here, so it just became home base for us.
Okay, all right. So let's get into it. Now, what were the expectations for the Swallows before the season? I know you came over in the spring and you saw some of the players before the season actually started. So what were the expectations going into this year, pre-corona?
Yeah, I think obviously for everybody, everyone's had to readjust how they think about a lot of things. But I will tell you that, you know, everyone's optimistic. It doesn't matter whether you are a team that's a perennial hot, you know, team, or somebody who has retooled. I think we were optimistic going into the season, but we also knew that we were very young. We had a mixture. We had Aoki and Ishikawa that were coming back, and some other players and some established guys that we were going to rely on, but we also knew that, you know, we had some young, exciting players like Murakami. So I think what we were hoping is that that some players would fill those gaps and step up, you know, and make us competitive. I don't think that, you know, if we were being realistic, we were eyeing the top spot, but I think we were looking at, you know, somewhere to finish in the middle of the pack. And unfortunately, you know, some players did perform well, but I think, you know, looking back in the season, I think some of that inexperience did come through. Mm-hmm. You know, I do believe there's reason to be optimistic, but I do think that the Swallows, you know, some of those good young players that we have, I think we're going to have to get those. And then, you know, obviously with my job as being an advisor, along with Tony Barnett, who we work closely together. In fact, you know, we have lunch at least once a week because we live close to each other. You know, I think it's part of our job to, you know, supplement what, you know, what we've done with some good quality foreigners and then, you know, try to give our team the best chance that we can.
Yeah, you dropped out for a second there, but I guess you were saying with the young players, you're just going to have to, you know, take the good with the bad, essentially.
Well, I think so, and I think with all young core groups, you hope that you draft well, you bring in some good quality young players, and then surround them with some good staff and some other players like Aoki, like Ishikawa, who have experience, and then let those players season a little bit and get improved. Because the Swallows were always going to be a team that is going to have to develop within, supplement some seasoned veterans, and then, you know, just hope we catch lightning in a bottle and then add hopefully some high quality, you know, foreign players to be competitive and successful.
Right. Now, you know, you guys, the team won the league title in 2015, went to the Japan Series. But why have the Yakult Swallows struggled so much to compete each year since that, you know, Japan Series appearance?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I can go on my experience there. We were competitive, but, you know, as far as, you know, the way that the economics work, obviously we, with the Swallows are just a slight disadvantage compared to maybe some of the other top teams. Sure. So we really do have to draft well. We really do have to develop well. And then when we get players like Aoki, when we get players, quality players like Yamada, when we have Aoki, we have to do the best not to, we have to do the best to keep them so that not only we have a high level of performance, but we also are surrounding our younger players that we're going to rely on, you know, to be surrounded by good quality guys so that they can improve. Because that, you know, as much as you can get young core, you need to teach them how to play the game right, and you do need to teach them how to win, and those guys are there. So we don't have the benefit, like the Giants or the Hawks, to, you know, every year just to use our financial resources to, you know, to fill in gaps. We have to develop well. And then again, you know, you look at the Swallows, we've had some really high-quality foreigners come in as well. So that combination is really the recipe that we have to be successful.
Now, you hit on a key point for me because I have my opinions about what kind of roster construction the Swallows should aim for. But when you see guys in the draft, when you're trying to build a team, for instance, is it more important, do you think, to get a guy who fits into your vision that you have for the team, or do you just try to go for the best available talent? How do you put together the team looking toward the future?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think it depends because I'm a little bit separated from the front office, and obviously with Michael Okamura, you know, my boss, my director, I know him well because he ultimately did sign me when I started with the Swallows, so I know what he likes. For me, just on a personal level,
sure.
You know, I think that as far as drafts, I think as far as the Swallows, you know, pitching will normally nullify, you know, a lot of offense. So I think that as far as that, I mean, for me, I would always draft pitching first. I would always draft as the best possible arm in that draft, unless there was a player like Aoki, you know, like a player like Sakamoto with the Giants, some things like that. If they came along, yes, I would grab them. But in general for us, you know, I would target, you know, the best arms in that draft and then build from there, because I think from there we can keep the score down and then we can build. And then again, from our perspective, how we can add to that instantly, or at least, you know, fairly instantly, is we can bring in a power bat in there from as far as a foreigner. I know with Takatsu-san, I know that, you know, he's a pitcher first, so I know that that's his focus, and that's kind of where we are at. But I do think that for a team like us, or maybe any other small market teams, you know, I feel that you take the best arm in the draft, and then you develop that. And then unless there is a generational player, then you can always go that direction as well. But that's where my focus. I'm offensive, but at the same time, I know how important it is to have that anchor at the one and the two in the rotation. And then it really, from a psychological perspective, when a team comes in, they know they're facing, you know, just a high quality pitcher, you know, one and two. It can really change the complexion. It can be intimidating, and as opposed to, you know, you've got somebody who, you know, you've got a number one, but nobody's falling behind that. You know, those you can really put yourself behind the eight ball if you don't have good arms there.
Okay, my philosophy always was thinking with the Swallows was to put a bunch of line drive hitters out there, and you know, if you can get the speed game going, that's fine. But it just seems like the team has a lot of slap hitters and looking to play a lot of speed game. And Murakami in the middle and Tetsutoya Yamada in the middle are good. And there's some other players who have a little bit of pop, but it just seems like the roster to me doesn't match the home ground that they're playing at, since they play so many games there. And I don't know how much opinion you can give us on that, but what do you think about a team that you would field at that particular park?
I think you're right there with your analysis of that. I think that would be, that's a good mixture, and then you groom players to be, you know, line drive hitters, and I think you're right. I think some balls end up leaving the yard, but you put the ball in play and you put pressure on the defense. I think that's good, because then you're not, you're there. But I also think, to add to that, what happens is if you have some high quality line drive hitters and Japanese hitters, and then you rely on the international department to put in a Coco Ballantyne, to put in, you know, an Alex Ramirez or maybe myself and those guys, and then just to create a little bit of havoc in the middle of the lineup, I think that's a good combination. I think that's effective for that ballpark. And then I think just kind of add to what I was saying, then you have, you know, some quality stars. You bring in a Seth Greisinger. I know we only had him for 1 year, but you bring in certain players like that can keep those, you keep the runs down to a minimum, and then the team doesn't get blown out. And then we seem to be in every single game. Then those line drive hitters, you know, you'll get hot for a little while, but mainly you're keeping the runs off the board and giving that team a chance. But I think if you struggle to find a philosophy or a character or a personality, and you just haphazardly draft, sometimes it's difficult to do, because 1 year you'll have a player, and it, like you said, it's not a formed team. And it's not a team that you designed for that ballpark. Because if you go into the Tokyo Dome or things like that, there's other teams that out there can go and buy those boppers, those heavy hitters. And once in a while, we can get a good quality guy, you know, from, you know, out of foreigners. But I agree. I think as far as signing free agents, I think you need to go with guys that can put the ball in play, hit line drives. And then, you know, hopefully, I'm not saying that there's luck involved, but you get a player like Murakami that, as far as projection, and then you develop him and you keep him in that lineup. But the Swallows are a team that are, you know, not that you compare them to the Royals, but almost like the new Royals. The Royals don't have the financial ability that some of the other teams do have, but when the Dayton Moore, when he came in and changed the culture there and really emphasized drafting and drafting certain types of players, they will go through seasons where, like this year, where they're struggled, but then they'll also have such a dynamic group of players because of just really solid drafting that you'll have years where they're just amazing. And I think, you know, I wasn't obviously there. I was there for some very good offensive years.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't there for the championship, but at the same time, you know, there was obviously some high quality players at that time. But with the Swallows, I think that draft is just super, super important.
Yeah, as it is for a lot of the teams around Japan. Now, Tetsutoya Yamada, he had a fantastic season in 2015, and I thought, I even proclaimed on the show that, man, this guy's ready for the big leagues. And then since then, he's incurred some injuries, he's had some struggles. But what's going on with this dude, man? He should be tearing it up.
Well, I have a lot of respect for him. I like the kid a lot. What he is, he's very unassuming. He has got a quiet personality. You know, an immense talent, and he's a lot of fun to watch and play with. He's got a lot of talent. I think that with all players, there are some players that are tailored towards being a superstar, There's other players that are tailored towards going to America.
Mm-hmm.
And other players like, you know, you watch Takahashi and Ogasawara. When I was there, those types of players, although excellent players, maybe don't have the drive to go outside the box and risk it to go and do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're very comfortable with being stars in Japan. And I think their talent level or their skill set translates very well into staying in the United States. So my gut feeling is I think there was a lot of people that were interested in Yamada. But I I'm just speaking from an arm's length perspective. But my gut feeling is that he was okay. He wasn't necessarily in a place. He might have been for a brief period of time, but I think in overall, I don't think that was his goal. I don't think that he is. He's not an enigmatic type of personality. He's not Iwamura. He's not an Ichiro Iwamura. He's not a Hideki Matsui. He's not one of those guys that I think wants to step on the stage. I think he's comfortable where he is, albeit, you know, we'll keep him as long as we can. But I think to go in the United States, there has to be a different type of flamboyancy and a confidence that you have to have. Because again, America, you know, the Japanese league is an amazing league, high quality. But again, it's tailored towards, you know, certain types of players.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he excelled there. You know, and it's very similar to Nakajima with the Wasebu. I was a big fan of his when he was there. Big fan. I thought he was a good shortstop, could hit the ball off the field with authority, which is something you'd absolutely need to do.
Right.
I thought he would be a player that would excel there. And then you see when he's put in that environment, it just didn't translate. So I think when guys, a lot of foreigners, we look at it this way too, that, you know, that why don't the Japanese guys just take a chance? Culturally, it's not, you know, it's not as easy. You know, in the States, we'll leave. You know, we'll go. In Japan, I think it's a little bit more, there's a little bit more to it. So I think with Yamada, I think although there was interest, I have a feeling that it wasn't a burning desire inside of him to go. And to be honest, I don't know as far as success level. You know, and if he wanted to challenge himself, I think that that would have been a, you know, something that, you know, that I would have been happy to see. But I just don't think that he was willing to go through what it takes.
Well, you know, yeah, that's part of his story, obviously. But I'm more concerned about the fact that he didn't go, but he hasn't been that same guy here in Japan. He was on an upward arc and he plateaued and he's starting to go downward. And that's the more concern. I'm glad to have him. I love to cheer for him. I like the swing. I like to watch him play. He's this base stealer. He improved his defense every year. He was just, he looked like, you know, he was going to be a superstar. And then that just kind of came to an end. And that's my biggest concern. You know, I'm glad to have him here in MPB to watch him play. But but I'm just very concerned about what I'm seeing in terms of.
Well, when you spend time around the guys consistently, and you know, and I haven't, but at the same time, I know him. He was there right when I was getting ready to leave.
Mm-hmm.
You can get a sense from guys' talent level. I think he, when I watched him, I was, I thought this is a good player. I was wrong. I didn't think he was a great player. You know, I thought he was going to be a very good middle of the lineup type of player. And then all of a sudden, as he improved, he far exceeded my expectations. So when he had a couple, you know, that monster period where he was just incredible, it really kind of shocked and surprised me. So for me, where, you know, I think he outperformed. This is just my opinion. I think he performed very well,
mm-hmm.
But I think his realistic where he was, I think, was just a little bit more modest. I don't think. Where his performance was, I think somewhere in between where he was and where he is now is a little bit more realistic. But again, as far as to stay at that level, you know, you've got to. He's not the biggest guy in the world, and
no.
You know, he's a decent size, but he's not a really, really big guy. So to maintain those power numbers, and then to, you know, and he's a decent defensive player, and playing second base, which should give him a little bit of a breather. But I think, just as far as that, I think there's a bunch of factors that come into it. But
sure.
I also think that, realistically, I think somewhere in between where he is now and where he had, you know, really good season, I think that's really who Yamada is.
Okay. All right. So now we don't see a lot of dynamic lineups in the Central League, it seems, and the Pacific League keeps dominating in interleague play and in the Japan Series, quite frankly. So why do you think teams choose to construct rosters the way they do in the Central League? Or is it just that difficult because it's, for instance, like what you're doing, it's hard to find foreign players who can actually get the job done here on a consistent basis, or there just aren't the pool that you're, you know, looking at here in Japan isn't that well developed, and you have to spend more time developing players. What do you think? Why do you think the dynamic lineups are lacking in the Central League?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of tradition there. I think that part of that is just been ingrained, just to be that way. I also think that that some of those, that it's just the way it is. I also think that different teams have different personalities, and right, wrong, or different, there's a lot of draft picks that I've scratched my head, not just with our team, but with other teams, and said, hey, why did we pick this guy? It doesn't really see anything. And it kind of goes back to what you're saying earlier about the draft. Like, I would always draft, for me, the best arm, especially in Japan, because you don't have that talent pool to draw from like you do in America. So you do have to choose wisely. You know, I've seen some first round picks with a lot of the teams over there scratch my head and say, you know, what were the scouts seeing there? And if you miss out on that first pick, it exposes you. So I think each team has a little bit different personality. I think the traditional ways of Japan, I think the teams, it's been that way for a long time, and they almost hold on to that.
Right.
But at the same time, as far as the draft and scouting, I think that it's very key that if you don't get out there and watch all the players and see the entire country and, you know, shake the bushes and get your eyes on everybody, you're going to miss some people. And, you know, especially like Swallows, you can't afford to do any of that. So
right.
I think it's a little bit of that, you know, the talent pool isn't maybe what is in America. So they have to hit that mark. It's also interesting, too, that I've seen it, and I'm not sure why, but I've heard of us and other teams saying, well, this other team is interested in that player, so backs off, or that person's from such and such a university, or someone such and such a city, and we're not, you know, I've heard some curious reasons not to draft the number one guy. So there's definitely some question marks or unknowns. So when we see teams that don't draft well, sometimes I think it's just they just have a poor system that's set up as well.
Okay. All right, we'll let you go. You said you had your son's football game, was it?
I am sitting here in about 95-degree weather.
Oh, nice and warm.
It isn't. It's still nice and warm. Just watching my son, just enjoying it. I tell you what, though, me and Tony had lunch, and, you know, we still crave ramen, just like we used to get down in Shibuya and try to get it. But we're really missing baseball. So it'd be, you know, as much as... It's just an unusual year, so we can't wait for things to get back to normal. Because visiting Japan, you know, time goes by fast. And to be away from the game and then reflect on how much, you know, fun we had and how amazing it was to live in Japan and play for Japan, there's such a different appreciation when you walked away. So, you know, for us selfishly, we can't wait for things to get back to normal. Because being over there and being with the Swallows and just being in that environment is so enjoyable, especially, you know, careers that we had and being able to get back and, you know, give back. And, you know, we really do have a dream job because, you know, you get to do what we love, and especially in, you know, in just such a great country like Japan.
Yeah, and we miss you, and we miss being able to go out to the field and just mingle with the players. And I'll tell you this, and I hope the listeners can appreciate it. Aaron Gile was a guy who would, before games, stand and chat with us for 20, 30 minutes just shooting the breeze. Before game. And I would always think, well, don't you have to go and play? I mean, you know, and you would talk to Rob Small, you would talk to Jim Allen, you would talk to me, you would talk to Wayne. And it was just a pleasure to have someone who just got it. You knew that part of getting the word out about Japanese baseball was part of the job, and you always took the time to talk to us. So we appreciate it. We appreciate the chat today. And I'm going to get you back on here because I want to continue to talk about what kind of players you are looking forward to bring over here. So we'll have you back on in the off season, hopefully.
Absolutely. Look forward to it. I appreciate the call, John.
All right. Good luck to your son in the game. Sounds like something's happening, so good luck.
Sounds good. Yeah, right. we just got a touchdown, so it's fun. So after this, it's just maybe a beer and pizza.
Not for the kids, though.
we are Canadian, so it's you start a little younger.
All right.
We'll give him a few more years.
All right, buddy. Take it easy.
You too, John. Take care.
Thanks. All right. Beer and pizza, baby. What happened to orange slices? When I was playing, it was orange slices. Maybe pizza, maybe hamburgers after the game. But anyway.
As soon as you say pizza in connection with Aaron Guile and some other research I did this week, another name popped up. And there's a bunch of names that popped up in thinking about Aaron Guile. And the pizzas like sprung a, you know, opened a different rabbit hole, but we're not going to go there. That's for another one.
What, as long as there's pizza.
Yeah. You know, what struck me, and I think the biggest thing I want to say how insightful Aaron is.
Oh yes.
And I mean this not in a sort of clandestine, oh wow, that was really cool kind of thing, but in the real subtle understanding of how Japanese baseball works, I was really impressed. I mean, because basically I spend, you know, I probably spend 4 or 5 hours a day for the last 25 years trying to figure out Japanese baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And he summed up a couple of the points, and I think the biggest one is the idea of philosophies and tradition. Now, he touched on this in a couple of places, but in the question of, you know, why do teams go for these players and why are there so many slap hitters? And it's a long story, but it's such a thing in Japan to fit in. Japan mm-hmm. is in many ways so much about fitting in.
Right.
And there's, I want to say, first of all, in Japan, sort of the prototype, especially for a middle infielder, is a slap hitter. He's trying to put it through the infield. It's not a level swing, as in level to the course, to the trajectory of the ball, to the downward trajectory of the ball, but it's horizontal because he wants to basically hit it on a hop or on a line through the infield. And not reach the gap. I mean, that's really the prototype. And now I think teams do love line drive hitters, but there are relatively few of them. And there's another constraint. And I had this conversation with Kenta Imamiya at the beginning of last season.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I asked him, what's up with the power? You know, suddenly the last 2 or 3 years you turned into a power hitter. He says, I always love to hit the ball far and, you know, high and far.
Mm-hmm.
But his job, as he understood it, was to establish himself as a regular player. He had to be more like the prototype middle infielder.
Gotcha.
Be, you know, hit the ball, hit the ball on the ground to the left side of the field. And then once he was established, then he could go back to driving the ball. And so we saw that sort of weird power curve with him. You know, he went from being a guy who's essentially his only offensive role was bunting to a guy who was hitting 10, 15 home runs a year.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's that. And there's a couple of other examples about that. But I also would want to mention something Scott Matheson said when he was with the Giants was he also looks at the players they draft and shakes his head.
Mm-hmm.
You know? He's not like it. And I think it's often a lot about, and in his case, it was the Giants' answer to these guys is, oh, they have a lot of baseball instincts. They're very savvy players. That was sort of the Giants' policy. And the other one that Aaron mentioned was also confirmed to me by the former Secretary General of the Central League when I asked the same question. What's wrong with the Central League? He said one problem with the Central League is that many teams don't want to compete with the Giants in the draft. If the Giants want somebody, they often will take a step back and let the Giants go for it.
Yeah, and that, I mean, I had 2 points, and that was basically one of them was the draft insight, because I just found it riveting. You know how I prepare for these interviews. I have, you know, 15, 20 questions that I want to get through. and usually I rank them, and then we start the talk, and I start cutting out the ones that get covered. But I'm sitting there, and I'm listening to him say these things about the draft. This give us this insight about teams backing off because another team's already interested. And I understand the whole dynamic of the player having a little bit of power here in Japan, in mm-hmm. that the player can say, you know, I refuse. I'll sit out a year, and he can.
Right, especially because the teams don't get compensation picks. They don't get
right.
like they do in right. the majors.
So you can end up really hurting yourself in that situation. So mm-hmm. if the player seems married to another team, then it's best just to go and draft someone who's actually going to sign with you. Mm-hmm. So I understand that dynamic, but to hear him explain it that, you know, look, there's a really talented player out there, just draft him. You know, and if he's willing to sit out that long, then he's willing to sit out that long. And we saw it play out a couple times. We've seen it play out a couple times, but it's not all that common an occurrence. So you hear Aaron discussing that part. And the other thing I really appreciated from him in this chat was him breaking down. Now, of course, that wasn't really my question, but it was interesting to hear him talk about why Tetsuto Yamada hasn't, you know, been that big league player that lots of teams want, that it seems like he wants to go. And for him to break it down and talk about the personality part, and, you know, the fact that he's fine being the he would be perfectly fine being the big fish in a little or smaller pond, mm-hmm. and that just wasn't his, you know, it wasn't in his nature to be that kind of guy who wants to go to the big leagues. Yeah, I totally understand that. I'm fine with that. I think that if you don't, you know, if you don't feel comfortable going, don't go, because the guys Aaron actually brought up, like Hiroyuki Nakajima, the fact that he went over and it just didn't work out for him, and Aaron was sure that it was going to work out for him.
Well, Nakajima, I think, was a different case.
Well, I mean, but that's what he brought up, and I understand yeah. that.
I think a better example of that was Kei Gawa, who was a really shy. I mean, he was a really good pitcher, but he is just a shy guy, and he was just really, you know, he's introverted. And some of these guys, and Yamada's not introverted, but he's also not, you know, you certainly sense he's not that sort of prototype. You do have to be a little bit of a me first, I'm going to do it kind of thing. Some degree, you got to be bold. And I think, but you also have to be smart.
Well, I was thinking the complete opposite guy or personality is Tsuyoshi Shinjo, mm-hmm. who went over, and I actually didn't think he would do very well over there, and he did fairly well. Mm. And he's so charismatic.
Yeah.
And he's got so much personality. It wasn't just about the baseball. It was about the guy having fun out there too.
No. I think in his case it was, you know, he had the positive, you know, he had the non-wallflower side of that. He likes to be on, you know, he was the prince. He liked to be on display.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And as the antithesis of
guys like Keigawa or Kensuke Tanaka, you know, just a
Kensuke
different kind
Tanaka
of guy.
Is another one who really didn't fit the profile. Now,
again, getting back to the draft part, I have feelings of ambivalence, and I just don't like this draft because it doesn't seem to be a design for competitive balance, but. It doesn't. If the teams are just going to play Yahtzee with their draft picks, then it's not. Is it not only is the draft against them, but they're against themselves. You know, how do these teams get better? And it made sense to me to see why in some cases some teams get into a rut like this, like the Swallows are in, and can't get out because they're not taking the guys they really think are going to help them. They're just going with what's available and, you know, the players who are going to sign, and, you know, that's, they're not helping themselves in that respect. And the other thing I did want to point out is that I wasn't sure what Aaron meant, and I probably should have asked him to give more information, but he called Yakult, he said Yakult is a small market team, and said there are, you know, other small market teams. And I would call Yakult frugal because this is one of the biggest markets in the world. I don't think it's a small market team, but I think that it's a small spending team. You know, they're not going to spend a lot of money. But if let's say the Swallows decided they were going to pour a lot of money into the team and actually really, really do whatever it took financially to challenge the Giants over a 10, 15-year period, I think the market is there. And if they won the games, they'd fill that little stadium every night and they'd make a lot of money.
Well,
I don't know about success, but they'd certainly make some money.
They would not. And the reason they would not is because they have to pay a huge amount of their gate to the owners of Jingu Stadium.
Well, then, you know, again, that's what I said, do whatever it takes. So if it takes another stadium deal or building another stadium, whatever it takes to do that, I think if they decided to pour the money in. I think if they decided in this market to find a place, build a stadium, get whatever it took to make this, to turn this thing around into a money-making effort or entity, I think they could do it.
I think so too. But the big one is, the really big one is to have their own stadium. Yeah. So obviously the stadium is a huge thing. And that's why you see now that when the Fighters move into their new stadium in 2023, that every Pacific League team will have the operating rights to their stadium.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Marines don't own and the Eagles don't own, but they lease. They lease the stadium for a fixed amount.
Okay.
So that means that they keep all the concessions and ad revenues and tickets.
Yeah, that's big.
That is huge because it's basically the teams play a flat fee. I mean, the stadium deals, I'm sure, vary quite a bit, but essentially they pay a flat fee, some millions and millions of dollars a year, and then they pay a per game fee, and then they pay a percentage of the tickets. For every ticket sold, they pay a percentage. Plus, they get zero advertising, and they get zero concessions. So, for example, when the Swallows sell you a Swallows shirt at Jingu Stadium, mm-hmm. The only money they get out of that is the wholesale, the price to sell it to the Swallows store.
Okay.
At the stadium. That's why the Swallows have a shop across the street from Jingu Stadium.
Oh, gotcha. All right.
Right? That's why that's why that happens. But in order to make money, they have to do that. Now the Swallows are a low spending team, but they've been a good low spending team. They've been one of the better. They've been, along with the Hiroshima Carp, probably the two best teams at recruiting foreign imports.
Mm-hmm.
For the cost, they've gotten more mileage out of their imports really than anybody, but really the Carp. So they've been really good at that. And he did mention Michael Okumura, his boss, and Michael Okumura has been doing that job for years and years and years and years. And he's not only the brains, it's like a mom and pop shop. He runs the whole thing.
Mm.
And he's done a great job. He's the one who's responsible for all the players that Aaron mentioned and many others. So that was really interesting. I do want to mention, you know, when he talked about the draft, I'm going to sort of backtrack a little bit. He mentioned that, you know, go for I don't want to disagree with his statement, his draft priorities, because I don't disagree with them. I mean, I don't have anything better to offer, but to say that, you know, they should go for the best arm, except for generational talents like Norichika Aoki and Hayato Sakamoto, I have to say that nobody thought they were generational talents when they were drafted. Norichika Aoki was a fourth round pick out of Waseda University. He wasn't on anybody's radar as a top prospect. And Hayato Sakamoto went in the first round because the Giants were unable to get Naomichi Donoe. And so instead, somebody who nobody named on their first round, Hayato Sakamoto, one of their scouts, said this is the guy we want. And they said, no. And they said, no, this is the guy we want. Trust me, trust me, trust me. And they said, okay, we'll pick Sakamoto in the first as our alternate pick if you just shut up. So they took him and he turned into a generational player, but nobody, I don't think anybody thought he was before the draft.
Yep. Yep. All right. Well, let's make a seamless transition and talk about the Swallows. And there's really not that much to talk about, except that they're headed for last place for the fifth time since 2013. And they were fifth in 2016. And they got swept, I believe, by the Carp in this weekend series here that just finished up tonight. And their ERA is awful. The team whip is awful. I understand what Aaron's talking about when he talks about pitching, because that has been an issue throughout this entire finishing in the second half of the standings, or not competing very well, or disgusting the fans, or having the fans turn off the TV when the games come on by the end of March. Oh, I'm sorry, that's when the season starts. Oh well.
Hashtag high heat.
Maybe the end of April, but their opening day starter this year, Masanori Ishikawa.
He's their opening day starter every year. I mean, it's sort of a team custom. In fact, I suspect that when he retires, they'll give him a one-day contract so he can start on opening day.
That's when they'll have his retirement ceremony.
Every year.
Next season after he retires.
They'll do it every year. He'll come back for another year.
So
you're not going to go in the Hall of Fame anyway. So just give us one good game and we're good.
One good inning, one good batter. But he won a game this past week, giving him at least one win in 19 consecutive seasons. And there's a good chance that'll be his only win of the year. And it was, I think it was last year that Zach Ikuma was on the show with us and helped do the prediction show and said, they're talking about Ishikawa starting on opening day. And this guy was the same guy they were talking about starting back in 2000, whatever. This guy played with Aaron Guile. He's been here so long, and he's still the best thing that they've got in terms of pitching on the mound. And, we can talk about the fact that they don't hit enough home runs, despite the fact that they're in a home run hitting park. They're only out homering the Dragons in the Central League. And there's so much to talk about in terms of how bad things are. And the one good thing, the positive, Munetaka Murakami, who has improved both at the plate in terms of drawing more walks, being more patient, striking out less. He's such a good young player, and he's even improved defensively, but he's still bad defensively overall. And he hit a home run tonight. Hopefully he can win the home run title. That would be something really nice for the team. But other than that, I don't see a lot of good things that we can even discuss with the Swallows.
I think the key point is the interesting one is the one that he mentioned about the young guys not developing. Mm. But I think one of the big problems the Swallows have had this year is that they're catching. I mean, they were so happy going into the season because they got Motohiro Shima from Rakuten, and Shima was so happy to be in Tokyo and sort of like to get a fresh start, and he looked really good. And he's looked really good when he's played. He just came back actually the other day. He's missed almost the entire season.
Yeah.
He was hurt early on, and they lost Yuhei Nakamura, who's their first pick catcher. They lost him before the start of the season, and he played about a week, and then he got hurt again.
Right.
So they've been using their third, fourth, fifth string catchers all year, and that's not easy for a team that has bad defense. I mean, their defense is adequate. I don't think Alcides Escobar, he plays shortstop and he plays third. Third is probably a better position for him at this stage.
Really? I thought he looked really uncomfortable at third. So much more comfortable at short.
Yeah, they have a problem. They have Naomichi Nishiura, who's a really bad third. He's mediocre as a shortstop. He's just not really a good shortstop. And so he's an improvement over him. Nishimura's got, however, has got some pop. He's like a 200 hitter, but he'll if you play him a full season, he'll probably hit 15, 16 home runs. And
wait a second. You said he's an improvement over whom?
In terms of power, he's an improvement over Escobar.
Oh, power. No, he's not.
Escobar is an improvement in defense over Nishiura.
Okay. Wanted to be clear.
Okay. But Nishiura's got some pop. Basically, his whole game is that he hits home runs, but pretty much nothing else. He doesn't play good defense. He doesn't hit for average. He doesn't really get on base. He's just a home run hitter and not really a great one. So, yeah, they've got a lot of holes. I mean, when you wheel out Yuhei Takai a lot in right field, you know you've got a lot of holes. And he's a wonderful guy. But he's just not a really good player. He hasn't been a really good player most of his career. I mean, you know, he was the first round draft choice as a pitcher, but out of high school. And he did pitch quite a while before he underwent a Yoshio Itoi conversion therapy. So
really, a therapy? Is that just,
you know, taking the, well, actually his problem was less Itoi had the live arm, but unfortunately the strike zone moved too much for him,
right?
That was his problem. He couldn't hit it, so he couldn't hit the strike zone, and so they made him an outfielder. And Takai didn't have that problem. I think his arm was just wiped out from high school and pro pitching that they put him in the outfield, and he did have some success for a few years. And he's game, and he's a wonderful guy. So, So the big thing was, I think, the failure of some of the young guys to develop. And I know the young guys that are talking about ones. I guess the principal, can I say perp? Taishi Hirooka is a guy I've liked for years, but he just never seems to. I think it's partly the team's fault because they don't really have a place to play him. They're not gonna, you know, he's of an indeterminate defensive quality. They've tried him in the infield, they tried him in the outfield. But he needs to play, and I think he'd be fine if he played because he was consistently good in the minors, but they can't seem to figure out what they want to do with him. And he has basically not given them a bat worth, you know, he hasn't changed anybody's mind about that other than they think he can play, but they're not convinced of it. So there's that. But I do like a lot of the young pitchers with the Swallows. When he said live arms, I think Shimizu's got a great arm, and I do like their rookie, the number two draft pick, Taiki Yoshida.
Okay.
Yoshida.
Yeah, we expect at some point next season, maybe Yasunobu Okugawa.
Maybe. At some point we'll see one of these high school first round picks this year actually pitch.
And the thing about this year is we won't know who the big angel or jewel of the draft is because they're not really playing any high school baseball, so to speak. We don't get to see them. We didn't get to see them in the summer tournament. So,
right.
They'll end up with a guy who he's not on anybody's radar because he didn't stand out in the tournament. And he turns out to be a quality pitcher.
Well, they did hold a 2-day tournament at Tokyo Dome. Yes. Did you see that?
Not for all the team, not getting that big stage and seeing the guys pitch.
No, they just invited a bunch of stars. You know, it was basically a tryout for the scouts, and they all wore the same uniforms and they all batted. Okay. So they looked at the pitchers and the hitters and the fielders, period.
Okay. All right. Well, we wish them luck, and thanks again to Aaron, and we appreciate chatting to him, and we'll see if we can at least when the prediction shows roll around next year, we can have, you know, at least three of the guys pick the Swallows not to finish in last place. But I'm not holding my breath. All right, let's make a four-seam transition and hit our mini track segment, our power ranking segment. And this should be quick because there wasn't too much great and there wasn't too much terrible. Just a lot of in the middle of the pack kind of a stuff. And like I said, I usually do this exercise by going back in my mind first and trying to remember who had a good month, in this case, September. And the first team that came to mind for me was the Marines. But actually, the team that won the most games in September was the Giants, and they were 19-6-1. And that's excellent. That just kind of slipped my mind. But they're playing in the Central League. It's not even fair. They're much better than most of the teams that they're playing.
Correct. And I picked two teams sort of I picked a wash. And I didn't pick the teams you did because I was informed before we recorded this that the power rankings only means how many games they win.
And you're just looking at win-loss records.
Well, I'm not. Who's I'm not. Like so tough.
And the accessories and the hair.
I look at also how they kind of won the games. So
yeah, if the model can walk, you know, can move right, and if the shoes match.
Okay, so John and I are working from different systems, but that's the beauty of the product. So I'm doing it differently. I picked two teams in a dead heat, and I picked the Giants and I picked the SoftBank Hawks. Although they didn't have a good month, they still had a good month. You know, they went 11-13 in September, but they didn't convince me that they still were not the best team in Japan.
Oh, okay.
Well, okay. So I'm going to still keep them up there. I what I saw was, they had some hiccups. Some of the arrogance started to show.
Okay. I can see that. Definitely see that.
You see them doing some funky things, it's sort of like they know they're better than everybody else. So sometimes they're going to try things out. You see, Tatsunori Hara does this sometimes. He'll play things sort of like he'll do weird stuff because I can. I'm better than you are.
meaner.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, we saw that. We saw that actually on Saturday, which is not October, when the SoftBank Hawks batted Keizo Kawashima, one of my favorite players. Fourth,
yeah.
You know, he's a guy with a, you know, he basically he's a really good player. He's a decent offensive player.
Stepping on bugs with that big kick.
Well, the reason he's a decent offensive player is, you know, he'll hit some doubles and he'll make contact and he'll draw lots of walks. So he's, you know, he has a useful role. So, but, you know, he's not really a top of the order. They do use him to lead off sometimes, especially against left-handed pitchers. And this
he's not a frontline player.
He really isn't. I mean, and also he's about 75 years old. So, so no, he isn't. But that was the sort of thing the Hawks do, you know. Ah. You know, look at who we're batting fourth.
Yeah.
Suckers.
You're having a fun night. My other team, my second team was the Marines. They went 15-11 in September. And even though they had a skid, I think they went up to Sendai and got swept in that series up in Sendai, as I believe. But at the same time, the Hawks were not really winning every game. And so they didn't really lose any ground. And turned around, they actually got even this past week in the standings.
They were in second place. Yeah,
well, zero game difference, so
okay.
Yeah, even enough virtually. Yeah. Virtual tie.
Okay.
And but they are now two games behind, so they got to figure out. I think they're playing this weekend, so
oh my gosh. Okay, so I guess we can just pencil in the Marines to be ahead at the end of next week.
Well, they'd have to sweep that series. So Hawks just, well, you know, we've got three games before that, so we'll see how it goes.
They have to play somebody in between. Bottom. Okay.
Yeah, the teams at the bottom, I'm just going to pick two instead of three.
Yep.
And I'm going to go with the Carp and the Swallows. The Carp
same
were 9-15, and the Swallows were 9-16. And so, they didn't look that good, to be honest.
No.
I thought they lost more games than that.
No, they were. Although the Swallows actually had a stretch where they were playing halfway decent in that month, but those were few and far between. But I think the big news is that the Oryx Buffaloes were not to be heard. So, in terms of for you all who understand Pythagorean wins, which is basically a ratio of how many runs you score, the relationship between runs scored, runs allowed, and expected wins. The Buffaloes were second best in NPB last September, and they had a winning record in September. So Good for them.
Yep, they were my third team, basically, in terms of the winners. But they were, you know, the Dragons also had a 13-11 record in that month in September. And the Lions were 14-12. So, again, two games over 500, all three of those teams. But I gave the nod to the Buffaloes, because if the last team wins 13 games or wins more than it loses in a month, I say that that team is punching above its weight class. So that was my tiebreaker, and I decided to give the Buffaloes a nod, because essentially if you're in last place, you shouldn't beat anybody. Everybody thinks they can beat you. So to finish with a better than
500. That logic falls on the other side of the fence from people are trying to beat you because you're number one. If you're trying to beat people because they're number one,
I didn't say they were trying to beat them. I said they think they can beat them.
Yeah,
I think you're trying to beat everybody.
Yeah. Well, I'm not pinning you. I'm not blaming you for the stupid things that baseball people say. So don't worry about it. Let's move on.
Well, no, this is not stupid things that baseball people say. I think, you know, when you have a team, I mean, let's face it. When you, whatever your sport is, let's say, you look on the schedule and say, this is going to be a tough game, but this one, we really, really have a good chance to win.
Mm-hmm.
And you either very confident or thinking, or you're very nervous. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're going to feel something before you go into the game. You're not a robot.
Sure. But
that's a game that you look on the
schedule. It's very hard to generalize, but you know, typically one excuse, I don't want to say it's an excuse, but one, because that's harsh. I don't think it's an excuse, but one pseudo scientific explanation for winning teams that do poorly the next year,
mm-hmm,
is often people were out to beat us. And very often it's a case. But that's probably one that many people trot out. And I find like so many arguments, if there's something to it, and I'm not saying there isn't, but I'm saying if there is, the degree to which it is much smaller than people, you know, attribute it to. Oh, we couldn't win because everyone, you know, there's a famous case. The San Diego Padres went to the World Series one year. It was 1984, I guess, against the Detroit Tigers.
That's Kirk Gibson, yeah.
Okay. And the next year they fell flat on their face, and one of the excuses, or one of the, I don't mean to use that word. I don't mean to be pejorative, but one of the explanations, the ready explanations, was everybody was out to beat the Padres. Well, then you look at this, actually, when you look at the schedule and you look at the pitchers they faced, essentially the argument is the other way around. The 1984 Padres actually had like the easiest route to a good record in the National League. They faced the weakest teams and the weakest pitching. And then the next year they went to Normal and they fell flat on their faces. I mean, they took advantage of their opportunities, but it wasn't like people were out to get them. It's like nobody was out to get them the year they won.
All right.
Okay. Well, anyway, moving along.
We'll talk about this some other time, because I'm sure some listener will come in with a question and say, John, you said this, or Jim, you said that. So
never happened.
So yeah, that's the end of that segment. And let's make a two seam transition and talk about the pitcher switchers. And this was a Jim topic, so we don't get very many of these.
I was sort of taken by the fact that Reed Garrett and Joe Gunkel were both starting the other day. And,
yeah.
And I thought, and then actually I misread
it. With the Lions and Gunkel with the Tigers, yes.
Exactly. And we've seen a bunch of this, because we've seen the guys plucked from the bullpens and starting. So Gunkel, who was the, you know, he was basically the seventh and eighth inning guy for the Tigers for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, okay, let's start him. And of course, one of the reasons they started him is because John Edwards came back. And so they had a middle reliever that they wanted to use. So, but anyway, just to get beyond the motives and all that, I guess that what sparked this was the move of two guys who were starters, at least this season. Yuki Matsui.
Yes.
Yuki Matsui, who was going to be the starter again. And I was
from Rakuten.
I was actually sold. I thought this guy can do it as a starter. I mean, he had a couple of, you know, he started down, and every start was getting better, and then he had like one down tick, and then the manager said he doesn't like it as a starter. He wants to go back to the bullpen.
Yeah, you read a report saying that?
Yeah. Yeah, sort of like the manager and the pitcher sat down and said, what do you think about starting? He says, can I go back to the bullpen? That was apparently the story.
Yeah, I would imagine this conversation went like this. Look at your numbers as a starter and look at your numbers as a reliever. And which one would you rather, you know, 10 years from now and look back and, you know, which one would you prefer?
Well, I liked him. I liked him. I watched three of his games, and I thought one of them was good and he didn't win. And the next one, he was very good and he did win. And the next one, he was good and he didn't win. And then he had a bad game, and then he's in the bullpen. So anyway, so there's that. And the other one was, the bigger surprise was Shintaro Fujinami.
Yes.
Another guy with trouble, although not trouble so much starting, but trouble with being consistent in any form. The only thing he's been consistent at is throwing hard.
And being wild.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, he just really doesn't know where the ball is going. And he's one of the guys you can actually see he doesn't know where the ball is going. No idea. But he honed in on the plate the other day and he threw a ball 161 kilometers per hour. What's that, 99?
161's
100. 100. So he hit 100 and, you know, got the woos and all that stuff, had a good inning, a nice clean inning, looked good doing it. So they said, hey, let's do that.
Yeah. I mean, he got clobbered today. I didn't see it, but I know he got clobbered. I mean, he gave up three runs in one and third innings, and he gave up a run in his first outing, but he's been okay. It's been refreshing. It's different. And we have speculated that he needed a change, and maybe this is the change he needed.
Yeah.
Another one was Hirotoshi Masui, who was
Zenshin Masui.
Yeah, sort of partying like it's, as I said in the blog, he's partying like it's 2016.
Because that was the last time he won a game as a starter.
That was the last time he was one of that when Shohei Ohtani had blisters that summer and was being held back from ostensibly had blisters.
Blisters or cramps? Yeah.
Yeah, whatever. Whatever the reason was that they just kept him in the batting order so he could, you know, work on his hitting. They brought Takayuki Kato and Hirotoshi Masui from the bullpen to be starters. And they were going like, geez, if we had known it this easy, we would have done it before.
Yeah, we would have done it sooner. Yeah.
They were really good.
But yeah, he was good on Wednesday. He threw six scoreless innings in a 5-0 win over Cebu of all teams. So you wouldn't think that he would, you know, lock that team down. He only allowed two hits, but he walked five.
Yeah.
He struck out five, but he walked five. So
that's almost like, I think when you face the Lions, you pretty much begin with five strikeouts and five walks.
I guess so.
You just have to assume those are going to happen.
Okay. But yeah, it was fun. He was the hero interview that night and just as unassuming as usual and said he wants to, you know, continue to work hard and contribute to the team. But the team's in last place, bub. So,
yeah. So that was just sort of a quick survey. I mean, we've had others. We had Nick Martinez is now in the bullpen and we don't know what's quite up with Katsunori Hirai, whether he's in the bullpen or in the starting. I think he's on the farm right now.
Yeah, he's probably like asking if he can get a new arm somewhere because
that was probably it. He's probably not saying, Skip, can I throw another 90 games this year?
Yeah. But there have been other guys, and Nick Martinez of the Fighters. I don't know what they're doing with him, and I did see him a couple times come out of the bullpen. Saw him get a save sometime, maybe it was early December, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't understand that, and he's been
I think with Yuki Matsui is that Wataru Karashima, who is going to be their seventh and eighth inning guy, who, you know, they took out of the starting rotation to make room for Matsui. they've decided that maybe he'll be the starter they want.
Yeah.
So basically, all right. they're sort of kind of going back to where they were last year, except with Matsui being in middle relief instead of maybe they're you know, when you take a reliever and you convert him to starting, you stretch him out. Maybe they're shrinking him. They're shrinking his arm because he was a starter and now he's in kind of long relief, and then maybe he'll go down to like an inning. I don't know. Honey, I shrunk the starter.
Okay, let's with that, let's make a one seam transition and go to our players of September. So this should be a fun exercise. We were kind of close last time. I think there were a couple of surprises. We don't know what these people are looking for, so this should be fun to see what happens this time. Let's go to this. Let's start with the Central League. Mm-hmm. Who do you have for pitcher and batter in the Central League, Jim?
My pitcher is Tomoyuki Sugano.
Mine too, but and it's a big butt.
Okay, don't be talking about big butts in my hearing.
Yuki Nishi is out there with more wins. Okay. More innings pitched, and I don't know what matters. I don't know what matters to these people. Sugano had more strikeouts, but you know the ERA is much better with Nishi. No, I shouldn't say much better, but it's under.
Hey, Yu Daiono was better than either of them, but he lost two games, so he's out.
Yeah, some poor defense and lack of hitting. He lost two games, and
and that's counting his hitting.
That's true. So okay, so Tomoyuki Sugano, I'll say they're just going to count the number of wins. I think they're gonna make Nishi. Although
it's like possible. I said before, they have done that.
Yeah, what I said before is a lot of times if a guy they want him to be the MVP, they start stacking up the Player of the Month awards for him. So there's a good chance Sugano will get there. But I'm gonna go with Nishi. He had the four wins. He's the guy for me.
Batters are kind of a tough choice in the Central League for me.
I think
the guy they're going to pick, I don't have a clue who they're going to pick, but one guy they could pick. Minetaka Murakami is a decent pick. Kazuma Okamoto is a decent pick because he had really good month, and he also had led the league in on base percentage, and they've shown that they actually check that now, which is kind of a new thing. It is a new thing for them because it used to be basically triple crown stats and stolen bases and that's it. So, but the guy I think is the more interesting, an interesting one is Takayuki Kajitani.
My guy, your guy who just went out injured again, right?
Oh, no. Okay, so maybe they'll have to give it to him so he has something to show for this year. Well, saying Takayuki Kajitani went out injured is sort of like saying, we're recording, so it must be Sunday.
Well, yeah, he got in the line. I mean, you said he was visiting when he finally got into the lineup earlier this season, and he stayed for a long time. He didn't get injured. And I don't remember what it was. Maybe a hamstring or something.
He's having one of those years that you get with players who are just really talented, but they can only put it together in fits and spurts. And he's one of those guys. And because it's every season is the story of when's he going to be healthy?
Yeah.
Because we've seen what he can do, but one of the things he can't do is stay healthy.
Stay healthy, but he has the 370 plus batting average over Sakamoto, 340 plus. I don't know. I tend to think Sakamoto's probably going to win this award. He had a little bit higher OPS. He drove in more runs, although neither one of them really hit a bunch of home runs. Kajitani had five, Sakamoto with six, but I think they're going to go with Sakamoto. So who knows what they're looking at. Indeed. Let's jump over to the Pacific League. Who's your pitcher over there?
I think no doubt Yamamoto Yoshinobu. Yoshinobu Yamamoto.
Yes, I agree. 4-1. Bunch of strikeouts.
Yep.
Only three earned runs allowed in his five starts, so that was pretty impressive. But I don't know how they factor these guys in, but I remember talking about Naoya Masuda, the closer for the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
And he has eight saves and a win. And he has really become locked down for a team that's really looking to go, you know, to the playoffs, maybe win the pennant and beyond. So he has been really sharp in that respect. So I would just wanted to give him a shout out. I don't think he's going to win. I don't think he's even going to be on the radar, but he has pitched well for that team. And that means something. Just because he can't throw a bunch of innings like the starters doesn't mean he hasn't done his job to the you know, better than anybody else has been doing their job in that league. So
he had 8 saves. But yeah, they do pick that. But, you know, and actually last year, I remember they picked an outstanding reliever, even when there were starters who went 3-0. So that was a kind of, like I said, they have been changing. They've been sort of, they're into sort of the last decade of the 20th century now in terms of their sophistication.
All right. What about position player for the Pacific
League? Oh, that's easy too. I think if you don't pick Hideto Asamura, then probably, well, I shouldn't say that, but to me, it's obvious. It seems obvious to me.
Yes. And those are the ones that we get burned on a lot of times.
Yeah, it happens. I mean, whenever they pick a guy who's, you know, one of the powerless giant, you know, 400 hitter who had, you know, who all his hits were singles and he had one walk in the entire month.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing about, you know, Asamura had 11 home runs. He drove in 24 runs. He was a monster in that respect, but he only hit .283, and you know they like the batting average. So I think because of that, I think Taishi Ota of the Fighters has a chance. He hit .339. He had 12 runs batted, and he only hit a couple of home runs, but so he had 6 doubles. You know, he did slug a little bit. His runs seemed to mean something. I remember him winning a couple of games with his hits. So
he had a long hitting streak. So, well, he had a long hitting streak. I don't know if he still has it, but yeah.
Yeah, I did tweet about that. I think it ended, but I don't know. I haven't heard much about it. Like I said, on these hitting streaks, they don't.
They're really bad with hitting streaks.
They're really close, and by that time,
you know, it's funny because they track the number of 3-hit games like it's required by law. But hitting streaks are one of those things that, you know, they're kind of streaky about. You know, they talk about when they're happening. Oh, it's done, so let's not talk about it.
Yep. All right, one note. Daiki Iwashita of the Lotte Marines tested positive for coronavirus on Sunday. I saw that report. I guess he tested on Sunday. The report came out on Sunday. Now, he threw on Thursday last week and didn't really, apparently wasn't really involved with the rest of the team. There was a staff member of Lotte who was also tested and tested positive. So they knew that today going into the game today on Sunday, and they just forged ahead. So we see what the plan is. If you test positive, you are isolated, separated, and you got to test positive before you got to test negative before you can come back. And that's that. So I guess, you know, like I said, they played today. They won today. The other teams know what's going on. It looks like everybody's fine with this continuing ahead. So that's that. Not a big deal, huh?
Well, one hopes. I mean, you know, one hopes that the information is being clear, unlike other circumstances where people have tested positive in the world. One hopes that perhaps it was a case of everybody else in the Marines had tested negative, you know, and he was the one who stood out, and then they checked the contact tracing. And it could have been that, you know, as it is with a starting pitcher in particular, that there are cases where, especially if the team has been traveling, where they might not be with the team.
Right. So, especially starting pitchers. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not inconceivable. I would believe that they are doing it. I think the Japan, and to be honest, if you're going to fit in Japan, you kind of got to do things the way other people do it. You can't be seen as an, if you're pegged as an outlier, you can get in trouble. I mean, you know, in a PR sense, there's no, you know, penalties for it.
Right. It's just Yeah, it's just not the way it's done. Mm-hmm. And you get singled out. All right, let's go to fielding questions. All right, the first one comes from NPB Card Guy in, I think it was Baltimore. Gosh, yep. Dave, tell me again, man. He sent by email and he says, I've been mulling the best way to ask this for a while. If I recall correctly, Alex Ramirez got some abuse from the press a few years back for batting his pitcher eighth in the lineup. I'm curious why that was when it looks like Tetsuharu Kawakami had done the same thing 50 years ago, at least in the Japan Series games I've looked at the box scores for. Like game one from the 1970 series. I mean, I know the obvious answer, but it's not an unprecedented move. And it's entirely possible that I'm not recalling correctly. And if so, I withdraw the question. Jim.
Well, don't withdraw the question. It's a perfectly good question. Okay. It's a two, and I'll be really short. I went into a really, really, really long explanation about this.
A deep dive.
A deep dive, indeed. It was a couple of deep dives, so hold your breath. But I'll keep it short. Essentially, you are correct. Not only did Tetsuharu Kawakami use it a lot, use it relatively a lot, it was a thing for all the managers. In fact, when Japanese pro baseball started, mm-hmm. It was more common for the pitchers to bat eighth than any other. That was the popular position for pitchers batting. And there were a lot of pitchers who were much better than average, league average hitters. So that was not really a surprise. And that's part one. And then part two is the reason, of course, the traditional reason people bat pitchers eighth is because they're better hitters than they're good hitting pitchers, right? Okay, so now we'll fast forward. Now, what happened was from about at some point, really, pitchers batting eighth kind of got fewer and fewer, and it had a kinds of ups and downs. But really, after 1970, the older managers, Japanese baseball was very freewheeling, really, until the 1970s.
Okay.
And to a large degree until the 1980s. But things changed. And one of the things that changed was sort of this drive to eliminate unorthodox behavior. Batting styles changed. Pitching styles were sort of, you know, this is correct, this is incorrect. I mean, Japanese baseball used to have people like doing every which kind of batting stance and pitching stance. And yeah. They sort of like, you know, the sacrifice bunt was something that was part of Japanese game, but the people in the 1980s who popularized it kept saying, this is our traditional way, but they took something that was, they bunted two and three times as often as they used to in the 60s. And they did it in an offensive context when home runs were really plentiful.
All right. So this is you being brief.
So I'm wrapping it up here. The point is, okay, they started making all these orthodox rules, and one of the orthodox rules was you can't bat the pitcher eighth. And it basically disappeared after 1972. It's not that it's smart or it's stupid. Mm-hmm. It's that you can't do it. And then, you know, once or twice, okay. But anyway, there's a much longer explanation and why I think actually start batting your pitcher eighth, especially if he's a really terrible hitter, is the best place to put him. That's all on my website.
Okay, yeah, I'm going to have to read that because I don't really get it. I'm figuring that it's a pretty much a guaranteed out most of the time mm-hmm. anyway. So who cares if it comes in the eighth hole or the ninth hole?
Well, yeah.
I don't think that that's a big deal. If you're
well,
putting
it is only because, you know, the same reason you bat your best hitters 1-5 is the reason why you want a better hitter batting in front of number one, because the batting order doesn't end when the ninth hitter makes an out. It's not cricket, you know, because if the pitcher,
I don't know what that means.
Well, but cricket, the inning ends when everybody makes an out.
Okay. Right. Okay. Well,
and then you start over at the next inning, start with number one.
But okay.
in baseball, if the eighth guy makes the last out, that means your leadoff hitter is the guy you have connecting with your best hitters is your worst hitter. And the cost of that is bigger. And
yeah, and I understand that.
It's
and
a small, I, but it's a small thing. You know, if yeah, you bat, if you pat the pitcher eighth in a major league season, the advantage is about two to three runs. Is it 5 runs a season? Something like that. It's minimal. Not a lot, but it's an advantage. It's a right. good idea to have a bad hitter batting eighth rather than
ninth. Okay. Yeah, I just, you know, I see the press talking about Ramirez, and they're mostly doing it because it's Ramirez. If it were maybe a Japanese manager whose team was winning,
they wouldn't care.
They wouldn't care. And if Ramirez's team was winning, they would mention it, but it wouldn't be a deal. But
oh,
it's only
no, they'd
a
still
because...
talk about him. About you know what they'd say? They'd say, "Look at all the games he could have won if he had done it the way we believe he should." That's how you do it.
Well, yeah, but if he were in first place, you know,
nope, they'd still say he could have won
15
more
games or so in September
the way he was supposed to.
But they'd have no argument if he's in first place.
No,
by 15
they'd
games
still complain
September,
because
even
it's
if
not
they
what
say
you do. Anything. It's
even if they say something. Yes. Okay. All right. Next question comes from Scott in Brisbane, and this is via email. And he says, "I have a question for you and Jim that might require some research. What was the last team to field 3 foreign position players?" And by field, I'm assuming he means put them in the lineup.
Oh, well, let's just stick with the starting lineup to be.
Yeah, the starting lineup at the same time. He says the Dragons are trotting out Diane Viciedo, Moises Sierra, and Zoilo Omonte tonight. And I guess this message came within the past week. And I was struggling to remember the last time that happened. I was thinking maybe 2016 might have seen Anderson Hernandez, Ricardo Nanita, and Viciedo in one game. That's for the Dragons. But I'm not really sure if that's ever happened. It might be a time-consuming question, so I'm happy if you guys could just look into it into the Central League, if that makes it easier. And that's from Scott. So I did research in my head, a quick scan, and I remember earlier this season.
You found something, did you, in your head?
It didn't take but about a split second, and I remembered this season when Jose Lopez and Neftali Soto and Tyler Austin finally got into the lineup together with the Bay Stars, and I would imagine that was in July. June, July. So, but
right.
Jim did some actual research, and what did you find?
Well, I didn't have this year. I don't have this year in my more detailed database. So
that's all right. I got my database in my head.
I know.
We're covered.
I got things elsewhere. The
hashtag high heat.
The
PG bro, PG.
Okay. So yeah, the Dragons did a lot of that in 2019. 2018. They did that a lot with the Viciedo Almonte and Steve Moya. 15 times.
Ah, Stephen Moya.
Yep. And the same year, the Rakuten Eagles did even more, 21 times with Carlos Peguero, Zelis Wheeler, and Yafet Amador.
Mm-hmm.
But the most interesting thing I turned up when I picked out how many imported players are in the lineup, because my database doesn't, you know, a guy is an import who becomes Japanese for one reason or another, or a Japanese registered player for one reason or another, is still imported and, you know, he's still marked as an import. So I came up across these teams that had 4 foreign imported position players. And that was kind of interesting. And the biggest team that did that was the Oryx Buffaloes.
And when was that?
2009 and 2007. And the interesting thing was I've got that wrong. In 2007, the non-foreign registered imported player was Tuffy Rhodes. And then when they did it in 2009 again,
uh-huh,
one of the players who was on that 2007 team who appeared in some of those lineups was now the non-foreign registered imported player, Jose Fernandez.
Ah.
And the other Mayo. One. And the last one, which is really interesting, which was the Yakult Swallows. In the last game of the year in 2007, they had Aaron Guile,
mm-hmm,
in center field. Hard to imagine, but yes. They had Alex Ramirez in left field. In right field, they had Daniel Yuichi Matsumoto, the former Brazilian. And then they had in first base.
He's probably still Brazilian.
Actually, he became – that's the answer to the question. He became a Japanese citizen, so he was re-registered as a Japanese.
Ah, because I remember him, yeah.
And first base, Adam Riggs, who goes with the pizza story. So anyway, that game happened to be Alex Ramirez's last game with the Yakult Swallows.
Mm.
And it was also Shingo Takatsu's last game with the Yakult Swallows. So it was kind of a memorable game all around.
Hmm. All right. Excellent question, Scott. And thank you very much, Dave. Anyone else who has a question, hit us up via email at yakyujohn@gmail.com. Or you can go to our Facebook page and leave us a comment. Ask us a question there. On Twitter, it's @JBWPodcast with the hashtag High Heat. Thanks a lot for listening to a long one. We'll talk to you next week. Enjoy your baseball.
See you at jballallen.com, I hope.
Follow the hosts on Twitter @JBWPodcast and @JBallAllen. Be sure to send in your questions with hashtag High Heat, and you'll hear from us again next week.